ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Kadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Would you say that creativity is at the heart of your everyday life? Or is it just something that you channel when you have the headspace, like over the summer holidays perhaps? Well, welcome to a creative edition of Big Ideas. We're coming to you from the Australian Festival of Chamber Music in Townsville, Queensland. G'day, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Yeah, and more of that gorgeous live performance later on. Now, whether you recognise it or not, I reckon we can say that we are all creative beings. But how do we turn what might be a little kernel, a creative spark, into something that blossoms and blooms? Well, I've got one of Australia's top creative writers here today to inspire you.
Writing a novel is planning and research and discipline and hard graft. It's also promiscuous curiosity and deliberate receptivity and creative collisions. And sometimes, with all of that working for you, sometimes it's also a bit magic.
Novelist and writing teacher Emily McGuire will sprinkle a bit of that magic over you today. She is author of 3 non-fiction books, 7 novels, including her latest acclaimed novel, Rapture, all about a female pope, which you'll hear more about shortly. And on the show today, Emily is delivering the 2025 Colin Roderick Memorial Lecture. It's hosted by the Foundation of Australian Literary Studies at James Cook University in Townsville, in partnership with the Australian Festival of Chamber Music. And she has given it an absolutely fabulous, very creative title, The Bible, Political Gossip, and a Splash of Frida Kahlo, on the importance of wild cultural receptivity and promiscuous curiosity in creative practice. Take it away, Emily.
Thank you all for being here tonight. So I'm going to start tonight with a few seemingly unrelated moments. The first happened in April 2009, while I was working on my third novel at an artist's residency in the Santa Cruz Mountains of Northern California. Some of the other artists invited me on a day trip into San Francisco to see a William Kentridge exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, and I decided to go along even though I had never heard of William Kentridge at that time. Today, he is probably my favourite living artist, and I will go to great lengths to see his work in person. But that's a laneway on a different creative path, and not the one I want to lead you through today. The creative path we're following starts after I had my first encounter with Kentridge's work, and profoundly moved and wanting to preserve the sensation a little longer before returning to the group, I wandered the gallery alone and found myself standing in front of a bronze figure, clinging upside down to the gallery wall. It was human-shaped, roughly life-sized, and despite it being in a crouch, it felt powerful, animal, and defiant. And something in me shifted. I didn't know what it meant, or even if it meant anything, I took a couple of photos. I looked at them multiple times over the next few weeks, and then I thought very little about it for many, many years. The second moment also happened during that artist's residency. I decided to start keeping a notebook. In doing so, and without knowing it, I established what has been the foundation of my creative practice for the last 16 years and counting. And the very first thing I wrote in that notebook was a quote by American essayist, critic, and novelist Susan Sontag. Pay attention. Attention is vitality. It connects you with others. It makes you eager. Stay eager. Now, we'll fast forward to well over a decade later. I was home in Sydney teaching a writing course called Year of the Novel. On this particular evening, I was talking about the importance of reading widely, and a student asked me how I managed to quarantine my writing from my reading. How did I stay in the world of the novel I was working on while routinely immersing myself in other fictional worlds? What is your safeguard, she asked, against rogue influences? And I was taken aback because I love rogue influences. Why would I want to guard against them? And I realised during the conversation that followed that there's a central tenet of my approach to writing and creativity that I had never properly articulated, even to myself. And so I began to think more deeply on it so I could recognise it and nurture it. If I want to sound fancy for a lecture like this one, I call this approach cultural receptivity and promiscuous curiosity. But in my own head, day after day, it's just, oh my God, that is so interesting, I have to write it down so I don't forget it. Or on the flip side, oh wait, this reminds me of that other thing, oh, where did I put it? Yes, I wrote it here, yes. In her wonderful book on creativity, The Luminous Solution, novelist Charlotte Wood writes that one of the hallmarks of creative thinking is associative thought, the ability to plausibly connect concepts and ideas hitherto thought to be separate. She references American novelist Richard Ford, who has spoken of how the joining point, the ligature between unlikely things, is where the new revelations of art come from. And reading this reminded me of something I'd heard the musician Brian Eno say in a documentary interview about his process. And he calls this import and export. I like taking ideas from one place and putting them into another place and seeing what happens when you do that, he said. Understanding something that's happening in painting, say, and then seeing how that applies to music. Wood, Ford, and Eno are describing the practice of deliberately thinking through how ideas and images from other works and art forms might spice up or deepen or otherwise interestingly complicate a work in progress. I think this is what Toni Morrison, a true touchstone writer for me, is describing in the foreword to a reissue of her novel Jazz. She writes that she had wanted to do something different with the structure of this book, that rather than, as she put it, a structure designed to enhance meaning, what she wanted was the structure to equal meaning. She, and I'm quoting here, wanted the work to be a manifestation of jazz music's intellect, sensuality, anarchy, its history, its range, and its modernity. Of course, then, Morrison turned to the music itself to create the structure for her book, which is polyrhythmic, improvisational, and with a strong melodic spine. Painter Georgia O'Keeffe also looked to music, which she believed to be the purest of arts, free to express something profound without the need for representational detail. She said she was drawn to the idea that music could be translated into something for the eye. And in her music paintings from the early part of her career and the later nature and landscape paintings for which she's probably best known, we can see, I think, the undulating shapes and washes of colour that evoke the sweep and swell of music. But as well as this kind of deliberate cross-pollination, I also believe strongly in the power of accidental creative collisions, the magic that sometimes happens when you're not deliberately joining, as Ford puts it, or smuggling and fiddling, as Eno does, but you're just greedily following your curiosity and keeping your creative and intellectual borders porous. An example of this that I love is the Broadway show Hamilton, a phenomenally successful musical focused on the seemingly unexciting, non-crowd-pleasing subject of the life of the first Treasury Secretary of the United States, and to be performed mostly in hip-hop. Many people over the years have wondered how a show with such an unlikely premise has become one of the most beloved and financially successful musicals of the century. To me, the more interesting question is, how did its creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, even come up with the idea in the first place? So the story goes that while on holidays, he read a massive, serious biography of Alexander Hamilton, just around the pool, as you do. Miranda discovered that this founding father of the United States was an immigrant kid from a disadvantaged background who worked his way to the top through the power of his words, only to be shot dead at the height of his fame by a rival. And as a fan of 90s rap and hip hop, Miranda saw parallels in Hamilton's story and that of some of his own rap heroes, like Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. Side note, though still on topic, Tupac, before he was a famous then infamous rapper, studied theatre and ballet. In interviews, he talked about how Shakespeare's tragedies and Les Miserables, among other works, influenced his songwriting. So there are creative collisions all over the place when you start looking. The thing about the collision that led to Hamilton is that you couldn't possibly plan it. The idea to write a hip-hop retelling of a largely forgotten politician didn't come first, and then Miranda set out to find research materials and references. The idea came from reading one thing while remaining open to seemingly weird or unexpected comparisons to other things. And you don't get this kind of wildly original collision if you only ever read one type of book or listen to one type of music or limit your engagement with ideas and culture according to genre or age or coolness or anything else. If Lin-Manuel Miranda didn't engage in a wide and diverse range of art and books and entertainment, if he wasn't curious about a wide range of topics, he never could have made the connections he did and the show wouldn't exist. This is why I indulge in, and encourage in others, promiscuous curiosity. If you're not reading, watching, listening widely and wildly, you can't hope to be making these kind of connections or coming across influences that could be transformational. This isn't only relevant to writers and artists. I am not a corporate creativity coach by any stretch, but I love this anecdote Steve Jobs used to tell about taking a calligraphy class in college. I learned about serif and sans serif typefaces, he said, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle, and none of it had even a hope of any practical application. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. Gates' calligraphy class and Miranda's hip hop and Tupac's Shakespeare, these are all samplings of what novelist William Gibson has called personal microculture. We are shaped not by our favourite writers, Gibson said, but by our general experience of fiction. Learning to write fiction, we learn to listen for our own acquired sense of what feels right. Gibson believes that what forms a writer then is, in his words again, not direct emulation, but rather a matter of a personal microculture. Obviously, he's speaking particularly about fiction writing, but the idea works more broadly. Jay-Z, writing about his generation of rappers, put it this way. We were kids without fathers, so we found our fathers on wax and on the streets and in history. We got to pick and choose the ancestors who would inspire the world we were going to make for ourselves. Your hobbies, the books you read, films and plays you watch, music you listen to, galleries you visit, your conversations, overheard sentences, all of it contributes to your personal microculture, the colour and texture and scope of your inner life. And the more diverse and wide and deep that microculture is, the more likely you'll create something that no one else has or could. I want to play this out for you a bit now and show you the breadth, depth, and weirdness of my own microculture during the writing of my latest novel, Rapture. The novel is inspired by legend that in the early Middle Ages, a brilliant young woman disguised herself as a man, followed her lover to a monastery, travelled the world, and eventually, still in careful disguise, ended up as Pope. Only to be revealed as an imposter in front of all of Rome, when she went into labour during a papal procession. wild story. I came across this legend in a book about early Christianity that I was reading not in the hope of finding inspiration for a new novel, but because it's something I'm personally interested in. It's a long-standing part of my microculture that mostly hums away in the background, but in this instance sounded a trumpet. There was this single vague paragraph in a very old book, and it jolted me into action. I had to know more. I immediately dropped everything else, and I began to research. But the more I read, the less I knew. According to the sources, which were written over almost a millennium and never by anyone who was there at the time of the events described, there was a female pope in either the 9th century or the 11th. She was either English or German. She studied in either Athens or Paris. She was beautiful or plain, a saint or a succubus, a brilliant scholar or a gifted con artist. As pope, she was either corrupt and turned the Lateran palace into a brothel, or she was wise and pious and greatly beloved by all. And when her deception was discovered, she was either torn to pieces by a furious mob, or she survived to become a nun, and her child was later made Bishop of Ostia. But forget the details, her very existence was hotly contested. Some say the story was invented as a cautionary tale aimed at ambitious nuns. Others, that it's vicious Reformation-era propaganda against the Catholic Church. Or maybe it's misogynistic satire targeting a female empress. Or. Every research trail led to more possibilities and doubts and theories and gaps. There's a collection of images that perfectly illustrate the contested nature of the story. It's in a digital database called the Pope Joan Project. And it's run by Drew University in the US. The project is an attempt to collect all the images of this alleged female pope, and then there's this whole subsection there of images which have been defaced, presumably over the ages by people furious at her inclusion in official histories, or in some cases, just the suggestion that she might have existed. Anyway, disappointed in my ability to find the historical figure, I let the idea go. Time passed. I wrote a number of other books set more or less in the here and now. And then it was March 2020 and the world became a bad horror novel, both terrifying and tedious. Wanting nothing at all to do with the here and now, I returned to these old notes that I'd made about a woman who, if she lived at all, did so far away and very, very long ago. And this time the haziness of her story made it all the more attractive. I saw that the gaps and disagreements were delicious opportunities for invention. If all of these scribes and activists and satirists and playwrights and artists from centuries past had made their versions, why couldn't I? The skills I'd gained and confidence I'd built in the years of creative practice since I'd first found the story surged up to meet my newly excavated excitement. I used my long abandoned notes to make a rough outline and I began work in earnest.
When good things come from hard times, hey? And creative projects certainly got many of us through that COVID period, including author and writing teacher Emily Maguire, who is generously sharing insights into her creative practice with you for this episode of ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Emily is taking you and an audience at James Cook University in Townsville into the process of writing her latest and seventh novel, Rapture. The inspiration can come when you least expect it too, and hopefully there's some inspiration here for you as well.
The first time I'd tried to write this story, I'd searched for a woman who may not have ever existed. This time, I searched instead for the details of the world in which this woman, if she existed, would have lived. And I wrote as I researched, or it's probably more accurate to say I layered research and writing over each other. I'd draft a scene, and as I did so, realised there were half a dozen things I needed to know to write it properly. I'd note down those things, but continue writing as best I could. And then I put aside time, sometimes at the beginning of each writing session, sometimes it'd be a whole day, to research the things in my notebook, and then I'd weave them back into the narrative. I think this is a really important point. I kept writing even as I continued to research. And the reason this is important to me is I teach writing and I speak to a lot of emerging writers, and the number of times I've heard an aspiring writer talk about gathering ideas or researching for a book, but who never ever gets to actually writing the book, is way too many. Writing is thinking, and it's synthesizing, and it creates its own force field, drawing in new and better and richer ideas. For everything I'm talking about tonight, every way of gathering ideas and inspiration, we need to remember that you still need to be doing the thing, writing words, making shapes or sounds, synthesizing and thinking through action. So, as I was writing, I was reading existing accounts of the alleged female pope. I was reading everything I could find on life in Western Europe in the 9th century, especially Northern Germany, especially the lives of girls and women. I read texts written by women in roughly that time and place, of which there are very few surviving. And so then I went wider, bringing in texts written by women in nearby places and later times. I used the Christian Bible as a primary source, and I delved in whenever I needed to go deeper into my character's way of thinking, of seeing the world, and whenever I needed a metaphor or image that would fit with her worldview. I read folklore from the time and place, religious texts that were in circulation, the English translation of hagiographies or lives of the saints that would have been available to my character in the 9th century. I read through the records from the monastery at Fulda, where she lives for a time. I read everything I could find on Athens in the 9th century, and when that proved to be almost nothing, I went wider, bigger time period, Greece rather than only Athens. I read books about desert saints, about asceticism, about the iconoclasm controversy of the period, and books on medieval Rome, where my character ends up, details about the Lateran Palace and various churches, accounts of how the papacy worked in that time, how the papal states and its landholdings worked. A lot of this was done during COVID lockdowns, so as well as a growing pile of physical books on my desk, I also built up quite a collection of e-books and journal articles in various formats, and of course I needed maps too. Some of these I printed out and had up on the walls of my room or spread out on the desk beside me. So all of that, and it was a lot, that was the deliberate structured research. And structured research, especially for a project like this one, was obviously incredibly important. But the thing about structured research is it tends to return you to what you already know to ask about. And sometimes what a work is calling out for is disruption or disorientation. And these are things that by their nature you can't hunt down in an index. And this is where the creative collisions come in. For example, while I was working on the novel, a friend invited me to attend an immersive digital art show about Frida Kahlo. I adore Kahlo, but I didn't love this particular show. That's for reasons not relevant to this talk. But in engaging with it, in going all in once I was there, and giving every exhibit the benefit of my full attention, I came out with half a notebook's worth of thoughts and ideas around representation of famous women, of how even a real life person like Frida Kahlo, who could and did speak for herself, can so easily become a romanticised legend. It never would have occurred to me to look to the life of a real 20th century Mexican painter to help me understand the legend of a 9th century English or German female pope. But because I left my borders open, it happened. I also had my creative borders wide open while watching a truly enjoyable and fabulously fun, but seemingly irrelevant to my novel, TV program called The Great. This is loosely, very loosely, based on Catherine the Great of Russia. It's irreverent and raunchy and clearly committed to putting story and spectacle above documentary truth. And the title credits even feature a sticker saying an occasionally true story. And it thrilled and invigorated me. At the time, I was deep in research and feeling bogged down by how the early Middle Ages were so often represented as dreary and somber. This show reminded me I could have a story grounded in an historical reality without having to be caged by facts or especially tone of other works set then. That I could and should allow fun and delight and humour into my book. At another point in my writing process, I went out for drinks with a friend and we got to talking about a political scandal of the moment. If you don't follow New South Wales politics, and I don't blame you, it may be one that passed you by. I'm not going to go into the details of it tonight, What matters for our purposes is that what started as a gossip session about news of the day turned into a creatively transformative conversation about power, love, and risk. And this happened because my creative mind was open, yes, but also because the friend I was talking to is a person of enormous curiosity, wisdom, and empathy. I really recommend having some of those friends, they're great. The insight that came from this conversation fixed for me what had been a stubbornly difficult plot problem and helped me understand the character I'd created on a much, much deeper level. There were other collisions. I'd read a book called Being Here by Marie Dariusz-Seck some years ago. It was about the painter Paula Modersohn Becker. I'd made a bunch of notes in my little notebook at the time, and then when I was writing Rapture, I was looking at some icon paintings from the 9th century, and I thought I remembered that Modersohn Becker had made a comparison between the big round eyes and direct stares in her portraits and those found in medieval icons. When I went back to look, I couldn't find the reference, but I did find an image I'd saved of Modersohn Becker's seated child with crossed arms. And I immediately saw that this girl was my character, who I had by now named Agnes, transported 900 years into the future. I can't explain it, and I don't need to because the painting exists, but this girl's expression gave me a sense of my character that allowed me to write her more truly and that lives with me still. On Instagram, of all places, I found an image randomly in my feed of a manuscript by one of the actual confirmed historical figures in my novel, the abbot of the monastery of Fulda, where Agnes studies. And this opened up a whole new way of thinking about the monastic section of the book. Then there was Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber, which I'd read years ago, but which shot back into my mind at the exact right moment, and from then on lived on my desk, pulsing seditious, carnal energy. And there was a poem by Nigerian-American writer Chris Abani. The poem is called The New Religion. It's from his book, Hands Washing Water. I won't try to explain this collision. You need to read this poem. And if you've also read Rapture, you'll get it. And then there's the influence of the unknown to me for the longest time patron saint of Rapture. So roughly midway through the writing process, I was wandering through the National Gallery in Canberra, where I was arrested by a triptych of tapestries. After standing in front of it for as long as I could, there were a lot of people there, I felt pressured to move aside, I slid over and I read the little plaque, and I saw that the works were called Earth, Underground, Sky, and the artist was Kiki Smith. And the name was familiar, and after a second, I realised that this was the same artist responsible for a picture a friend had sent to me after we'd had a long talk about my book's protagonist. The work my friend sent me was called Lounging with Wolf, and I only had a screenshot that I'd printed and stuck over my desk. I'd never seen it in person. Back at my Canberra hotel that afternoon, I Googled Kiki Smith, and one of the first images that came up was a bronze sculpture of a woman emerging from the body of a wolf. It stopped my breath. I took a screenshot and I kept scrolling. And then came a full body shivers moment as another bronze sculpture by Smith popped up. And I was instantly transported back to San Francisco in 2009, back where I started this lecture, the beginning before the beginning. It was the crouched figure on the wall, the one that had created a shift in me that I didn't understand. And now in Canberra, in 2022, in my hotel, heart thumping, I trawled through my photos and I found way, way back the images of the work that I'd taken then, still waiting for me there on my phone. All four of Kiki Smith's works that I had collected, the tapestry triptych, the drawing, the two bronze sculptures, became touchstones for Rapture. Printouts on the wall in front of me as I wrote. And I couldn't exactly explain why they resonated so much, but it was something to do with the mix of mythical and human, of carnal and spiritual, that they communicated and that I was going for in this novel. Looking at them helped me keep touch with this. Final fast forward, another couple of years, I was finished writing Rapture. It was on its way out into the world. And I sat down to make some notes about the various touchstones and influences. I wanted to reference everything properly so I could name them in talks just like this one. So I looked up the Kiki Smith bronze sculptures again to find their names. And you wouldn't believe it. Or you might. The sculpture I'd been transfixed by in San Francisco is called Lilith. Lilith, who is a folkloric and mythical figure whose story and really whole vibe is powerfully resonant with my character of Agnes. And the other sculpture, the one with the figure emerging from a wolf, that's called Rapture. And I had no idea the whole time I was looking at it for energy and inspiration. And even if I had somehow subliminally learnt the name of the sculpture, I wasn't the one who came up with the name for my novel. My editor did. So I'd been looking at this unnamed, to me, sculpture the whole time I was working on my manuscript, which had a very different name. I didn't yet know the true name of the sculpture or of my book. I couldn't have known they were the same. And this story has now become a touchstone for me and all my work going forward. So it reminds me that writing a novel is planning and research and discipline and hard graft. It's also promiscuous curiosity and deliberate receptivity and creative collisions. And sometimes, with all of that working for you, sometimes it's also a bit magic. I want to finally come back to the idea of attention and receptivity and how these things work or don't when one is consuming voraciously. Because I get that these things can seem antithetical. So I want to underline that what I'm talking about is promiscuous curiosity, not promiscuous attention. It's beyond the scope of this lecture to talk about the trouble so many of us have concentrating on any one thing for more than a few minutes. So attuned have we become to dopamine hits from scrolling and notifications. But I will say that one of the first things I ever discuss with new writing students is how to switch off from digital distraction and relearn focus. It's incredibly important to creative practice, in my experience. What I want is to be taking in lots of different kinds of culture, but not all at once. Not as someone I know found themselves doing recently, watching a film on TV with a book open on their lap to read during the ad breaks and TikTok open on the phone with notifications for Snapchat incoming just in case they miss something. The goal isn't to be across the most stuff or to be across it at the same time. It's to be receptive to the ideas and images and language that light you up, that spark, that provoke. And when you do come across them, to pay attention. To look at the painting or sculpture longer than feels comfortable. To put down the phone and close your eyes and let the music be everything. To read a poem slowly and out loud so you feel each word in your mouth and the rhythm of each line in your breath. And also to pay attention, to attend to your own life, your own world. You've heard me mention several times tonight my notebook or my notes. I happen to have a really, really bad memory, and so anything I don't want to forget, I write down. And of course, many people do this with appointments, but back in 2009, I began the habit of doing it with lines from books I was reading, art I looked at, ideas I had on the bus, overheard conversations, a bird I noticed revisiting the tree outside my window, the surprising colour of a coat someone walking past was wearing. And I'd been doing this for years before I came across the term swipe file in Austin Kleon's book, Still Like an Artist. He calls it a swipe file because, in his words, it's a file to keep track of the stuff you swiped from others. I read that Beethoven kept what he called conversation books, in which he'd note down tasks he had to do and shopping lists, but also details of debates with friends, commentary on art and love, and sometimes musical themes that can later be found in his compositions. And way, way back in the day, Aristotle suggested his readers collect ideas and sayings the way a bee collects pollen. And in my beloved Middle Ages, people collected Bible passages and bits of commentary together into books they called florilegiums, gatherings of flowers. So call it a swipe file or a conversation book or a honeypot or a gathering of flowers. Call it, as I do spectacularly, notes. But I urge you to get into this habit of gathering the joys and curiosities of your days. Not because one day you may find the perfect starting line for a novel or inspiration for a painting, or not only because of that. And not because it's just really cool to be able to look back 5, 10, 20 years and realise something that stopped you in your tracks then has continued to work away in your subconscious the whole time. Or not only because of that. I urge you to gather the joys and curiosities of your day, because to do so is to be active in paying attention. And this is worth doing, because Susan Sontag was right. When I pay attention, I feel more vital, more engaged in life in general, not just in the thing I've been paying attention to. I invite ideas and inspiration and creative collision into my writing, but I also feel more connected to other people and more excited about the present and the future. I feel more alive. And that's why, whether you're making art or simply trying to live a better, bigger, more engaged and more hopeful life, I urge you to be promiscuous with your curiosity, to make your borders porous, your mind and heart more receptive, and pay attention. It's vital. Thank you.
Look up, pay attention, write it down. Tips for a creative life from Australian author and writing teacher Emily Maguire here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. It's so great to have your company. And that was Emily's 2025 Colin Roderick Memorial Lecture at James Cook University in Townsville. It was hosted by the Foundation of Australian Literary Studies. And as you'll hear, this event was held in partnership with the Australian Festival of Chamber Music. Emily now takes some questions from the audience in the room.
Thanks, Emily. That was a really fantastic talk. I really like this idea of receptivity as a practice or is a practice. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on to what extent, if any, that extends to how you think about the ethics of writing. So in Rapture, you're writing about a sort of potentially real, potentially fiction. And I know that you think deeply about ethics and writing. So I was just wondering if there's a connection there between those ideas.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. In terms of Rapture, yes, a potentially real person, but if she was real, no one here knew her or can ask her how she felt about any of it. So that's a little bit fair game. But I take the spirit of your question that certainly there's a whole other lecture here that's about what is mine as a writer to use. I can be getting inspiration from all over the place, but not all stories that I come across or that I come across is or should be mine. That there are certain boundaries around these things that exist if you want to be an ethical writer or creative. And I think that is part of it. And I think that's part of when I talk about really paying attention or really engaging deeply, it's not skimming stuff like, oh, this little thing I heard here will sound really cool, so I'll just throw that in without actually finding out about the people behind it or the culture behind it. It is about really engaging with the ideas that light us up. And as part of that, thinking through whether there are going to be ethical clashes, whether it is my story to tell.
Firstly, thank you, Emily, for your amazing talk this evening. This question is about the character of Agnes. And if she were born today, what type of person and who would you think she would be?
Oh, that's that's such a great question. The thing about Agnes is, as she sort of ended up being creative, so I'll go back a little bit. When you hear about this idea that there was once a female pope, and this is in the name of that university project that I mentioned, she's usually called Pope Joan, and this has become a kind of a mythical figure, and there's a lot of great stories around that and some not great ones. I deliberately didn't name her that because I knew I had to start from scratch. So even though I could research all the world around her, she had to be an original fictional creation. And I thought going in that she was going to be someone who was hugely ambitious. But as I wrote her and dug into especially the lives of the saints and the religious texts, I actually realised that my female pope, Agnes, was someone who's deeply, deeply devout. And as I wrote, I realised it didn't matter if I believed in God or if my readers believed in God, but that everyone believed that Agnes really believes it, because that is what's driving her, that she feels called and that she, you know, carries on this deception because she just thinks, these guys don't get it yet, that being in this female form doesn't stop me serving God. But I know it and God knows it, so this is okay. And there's a few ways to think about how that would play out in the here and now. But what it comes down to for me is, first of all, if she was exactly as she was then, there are many more options for her. Even 100, 200 years later, there were convents she could have gone to, where there were nuns like Hildegard of Bingen who were incredible scholars and creatives and building sort of little minuscule feminist utopias in the convents. That didn't exist. That existed in England at that time, more a little bit. It didn't exist at all in northern Germany, where she was, for another 100 or so years. And so that wasn't an option. Now, of course, there's not just convents. There's all kinds of things for a woman who feels called to serve God in that way to do. I think the larger idea there that maybe a lot of readers respond to, though, is this idea that's unfortunately still incredibly relatable and obvious, that all kinds of people, because of their appearance or their census category or their demographics, other people look at and think, this is not for you. And that this is the kind of thing that that Agnes somehow has, I guess because she thinks God's talking to her, the ability to push back against that and to ignore all those societal messages that someone in this body isn't for this. And that's what I think should be doing that in some way now. Yeah, thank you for the question.
Well, mine was pretty simple. What was the working title?
It's really bad, and I know that now, but I was quite in love with it. The working title, which I thought was the title, was John the Englishman, which I thought was really clever because, so that was, if she existed, that was her papal name. She was John the Eighth, and people described her as English because her father was English. So I thought, well, her name's not John, and she's not English, and she's not a man. How clever to call it John the Englishman. But of course, you need to have read the whole book for that to even make any sense, and it's just not catchy or marketable. So my wonderful British editor, Fede, with my Australian editor, they sent me an email saying, how married are you to this title? Can we throw around some ideas? And it was Fede who suggested Rapture, and as soon as I heard it, I went, yeah, that's it.
Thank you so much. I've just been blown away by all the various suggestions and connections that you've made. I'm here with the Australian Festival of Chamber Music, and so I'm not even sure if it's a question, but what you have talked about and writing itself, there's a certain static product at the end, mm-hmm. and so you're able to layer influences and indeed artworks and so on. They're all... once the artist has completed them, you know, you're taking a static work. Whereas what we're seeing on stage with the festival is a whole lot of performers essentially being receptive in the moment. Mm. And I was curious if there's anything in your practice or your teaching which talks about that reception to creativity in the moment as the performance is being created.
I love that question and that idea. And it's not something I have a lot of experience doing because my work is something that is reworked over and over and over before it's sent out there. I would love to hear a performing musician speak about that process and how that works. Like that's something that I feel like I need to draw into my microculture to understand more about that. The closest thing would be a couple of writing students I've had who, as well as writing in longer form, do slam poetry or performance poetry. And that often is, I mean, practices vary, but often there will be a written text, but it's not read the way you might read a poem out of a book. And it can be performed in the moment, and it can respond to things in that space. I think that would be something in terms of hearing the poet who went before, and I'm not talking about like some staged rap battle where they're responding to each other, although that is also that, but it is the actual variation on the poem that started on the page as it's being performed. But yeah, I feel like I want to move right towards what you're asking now and know more about that.
Hi, Emily. Everything that you've said has really resonated with me. Good. How can we hear more from you? Oh. You know, do you have a blog? I don't know. I'd love to hear more from you.
Oh, thank you. That's a really lovely thing to say, and I appreciate it. I don't have a blog. I have an Instagram, but I don't really write much on there. Most of my ideas like this will come out in my teaching and occasional lectures. So I do have a website where those things will be listed, and I do various teaching and classes around the place. But thank you. That's really nice.
I'd just like to say thank you. It was a wonderful lecture. And we came up to go to the festival and we found out about this, and it's been so wonderful. But I wondered if you'd actually heard Melvin Bragg speaking about Pope Joan on his amazing program. Have you heard that on the BBC Sounds?
I think I did. I think I've listened to pretty much everything. I can't remember that specific conversation. There was another one on The Rest Is History, which is a very popular history podcast, yes, where they were scathing about the possibility that she could, yeah, be true. And I can't quite remember what tone Melvin Bragg took. But
Melvin Bragg, of course, always interviews the, yes, three top people in the UK or elsewhere about the subject. And we actually listened to it yesterday as we were travelling from Cairns.
Oh, so it'll be very fresh for you.
And I just thought I'd just tell everyone else about it, because as an afterward, it was such a good program about Pope Joan. And he said in that, one of the researchers, that the actual librarian at St. Peter's in the Vatican says that she definitely did exist. Mm. So I thought that was very interesting. I just thought
I'd add that. Thank you. Yeah, and I might have to re-listen. So I'll just add as a note to that for anyone who's interested. One of the things that really struck me about this story, so not the story I'm writing so much as the story of the story, the legend that's lived for so long, is that although we can't possibly know whether it was actually true or not now, and evidence seems to work against it, what we do know is that people believed it was true for hundreds of years in the Middle Ages, and that the existing sources, the earliest sources, were from within the Catholic Church. They were Dominican monks, the first couple of sources that we still have. It was reported as an oddity, but a fact, and it was accepted. And there were a few different memorial plaques and such around Rome, especially in the place where she's said to have given birth, which the story says used to be the sacred way because the Pope would go that way. Now it's the shunned way because of this. And in Siena, in the cathedral, there were busts of the various popes, and there was a vaguely female-looking one there for a while that had underneath it John the Englishman, a woman. So it wasn't until really the Reformation, when it did start to really get told as anti-Catholic propaganda, that I think it was Pope Clement the something, he officially declared it not true. So the story has been told at least since the 11th century, and that was 1600 or 1601 when it was officially not true. So to me, it just remains really interesting that for all those years, people did just basically affect, there was a woman once.
All right, thank you, Emily. Please join with me to thank Emily one last time. You've been so generous with your time.
And wouldn't you love to be a student of Emily Maguire's? Perhaps you have been. Emily is a writing teacher and author of many books, including the one you've heard plenty about today, Rapture, as well as An Isolated Incident, Love Objects, and more. She was speaking there with an audience in Townsville for the 2025 Colin Roderick Memorial Lecture. It's hosted by the Foundation of Australian Literary Studies at James Cook University in partnership with the Australian Festival of Chamber Music. And speaking of chamber music, here on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app with me, Natasha Mitchell, let's hear some of that beautiful music. And a performance at the event by students from Adelaide's Elder Conservatorium, known as the Vanya Quartet. They're playing a piece by Toowoomba composer Bel Shimibert called Saoirse, which is the Gaelic word for freedom. Thank you. And finding the freedom to create was the Vanya Quartet, beautiful, playing the piece Saoirse, which is Gaelic for freedom. And that piece was composed by Toowoomba's own Belle Schmibear, with thanks to the Australian Festival of Chamber Music and James Cook University for today's terrific event on Big Ideas, all about creativity. We come to you across the nation on ABC Radio National and whenever and wherever you like on the ABC Listen app. Just search for Big Ideas. And don't forget, you can get in touch with us by email, and that address, bigideas@abc.net.au. We really love hearing your thoughts on the big thinkers that we bring you. Sometimes you don't agree with them, sometimes you do, and we love hearing it all. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Thanks for joining me today. Bye.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.